Today we have incredibly talented guest with us, Noah Asanias. Noah is a distinguished photographer who has mastered the art of storytelling through his visually captivating images. He helps brands tell stories that foster brand loyalty and drive sales, working with notable clients like Essence, Netflix, and Aritzia. I first connected with Noah when I was looking to shoot some editorial shots and headshots for my first business, Remint, prior to starting Oko. And since then, we've been collaborating frequently. So I'm so excited to have you here today and share a bit of your story. Noah, your career has seen so many pivots. And can you take us back to the very beginning and tell us about how you got to where you are now?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for having me.
Of course.
So my background is I was an art director before I became a photographer. I was working in Asia. But to cut the story short, let's start with me being a photographer. So originally I came to Canada for my sister's wedding, ended up liking it. And for me to stay, I needed to go to school to stay longer. And that's when I decided to pursue photography, because why not? Wasn't thinking of making it into a career. It's mostly just kind of like a 1 year vacation from Philippines, if that makes sense. But while I was in school, I looked for other professional photographers that are already working in the industry. And I found one headshot photographer that's also a food photographer and one fashion photographer from the States that recently moved back in Vancouver. I shadowed these people for one of them for like the whole 2 years, I think. And another one is for about a year. And I really learned a lot from these two photographers. But I didn't learn the business aspect of that. I learned how to shoot or the technicality. And then I started working in-house as a photographer for a fashion brand in Vancouver. Left that company after 6 months to pursue entertainment world, like shooting portraits and movie posters. So that's kind of like the grand macro look of it, I guess.
Okay. Were there any pivotal moments throughout your time as an art director or even prior to that, that you feel like propelled you to where you are now?
There was this one photographer in Philippines. I used to hire him for commercials like McDonald's, for example. And he was a lot younger than me. I think I was about 19 at the time. He was 17. And he's already doing covers for Vogue in Asia. And I really admired this person. And I was really jealous at his lifestyle, because I got to know him through the jobs. And I would ask him, say, hey, man, like, what's life like as a photographer? And he seems like he would only work for maybe two times a week. And not that you can't do more, but that's what he wanted at the time. And I got really jealous of that. And through that, I think I became really interested in photography. But I never really pursued photography until I was 25. I graduated university young in the Philippines. I graduated at 18. Started working in an ad agency, working a different couple of jobs from being, at the time, we call it a graphic designer, visualizer. So work as a graphic designer, worked my way up as an art director, quit that, went back to my folks and helped them with the business. We have a pharmacy chain in Asia. But yeah, I don't know if I answer your question.
Yeah, I think that observing people that you look up to, especially at a young age, really does drive you in a different direction. That's something I always talk to people about now, is that we live in such an interesting time with being able to absorb mentors from afar through people like influencers and thought leaders. I feel like we now have opportunities to take in so much more information from those inspirational figures than we used to have earlier, like in our young childhood. So yeah, it's interesting how that can really shape you and mold the direction you go in. You have an impressive client list, including personalities like Jamie Dornan, Melissa McCarthy. What has been the key to attracting and maintaining these relationships?
I love that you focus on the relationship aspect, because a lot of photographers that I meet are very technical. They focus on lighting, on posing, or buying more equipment. As a photographer, as an entrepreneur photographer, or a photopreneur, that's what I call it, it's not really about a technicality. Well, it is in a sense, but it's more about your relationship that you build and your marketing. For me, the reason I think I get hired by brands or private clients that I have, not just because they like my image, but it's, I think, more because they like being around me. And that's something that I've kind of been telling a lot of creatives, not just photographers, that your portfolio is just something to put you in the front door. But for you to enter and to stay there, it's definitely a relationship building. So one of the ways that I would do that is I like to curate the environment in the studio or wherever I'm shooting, depending on who I'm working with. If I'm working with kids, for example, what do they like to do? Especially with teenagers, for example. Teenagers usually want it to be an adult in a way. They want it to go out and party, but they can't yet. So scenarios like that, for example, I would hire a DJ on set to play maybe rave music and everybody's having fun. Now, if I'm shooting someone who's older, for example, I would go for maybe a little bit more of a jazz music in it. That being said, it's not only about music that you can curate the environment. A lot of it as well is how you welcome them. For example, if you go to a Rolex store, they're wearing a white glove. They don't really need to wear a white glove, but it's all about the experience of how you present your product. That is definitely one of the key things in how I build the environment and relationship. Another one is constant communication. Now that I'm doing mentorship, for example, or I build this community online for to help other photographers, I noticed that a lot of them would wake up at around maybe 10 in the morning, 11 in the morning. My day-to-day is very different. Mine is about 6 or 7 a.m. I'm awake. I'm already calling people, especially at 6 because some of my clients are in the East Coast. I'm already on the phone with them. I'm already sending them emails to make sure that I stay under radar outside my newsletter and social media. These days, it's so hard with the algorithm of Instagram, for example. We can't really rely on just posting in the right time, at least for me. It's about relationship in the right time anymore. Now I'm relying more on my engagement. For example, if I have a client that I really connect with, I try to remember when their birthday is and simply putting it in the calendar, right? Like a simple happy birthday message to a person, sometimes like, oh, they remember. Or randomly, I would send a card maybe just because I thought of them. So little things like that, I think, is what really matters in building relationship and being genuine to whoever you're interacting with. And yes, there are going to be times where you don't fully connect with the subject or the client. And that's okay. They're not the people that you want to be working with anyways.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's something that I've always noticed about you, is that you create a very different environment within your studio based on the client that's coming in. And I've witnessed that through doing so many shoots with you through Oko, just seeing the way that things are set up and the music that's playing and the whole scene that's been set when we come in with different client types. And I think that that's so important. And I think something that probably a lot of photographers overlook in terms of making clients feel comfortable. I think even the way that you give direction to someone who is getting headshots and has never had a professional photo taken of them before versus a model who is very familiar in the environment is so different. And I think that that's a really important skill set in maintaining those relationships, like you said. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So going back to your work itself outside of the relationships, I know that your work is known for its meticulous attention to detail, especially when it comes to lighting. Tell us a little bit more about that. How did you develop that particular style? Did it come from a general attention to detail, or is this photography specific?
Funny thing about, I don't think I pay attention to a lot of details, but it's one of those things that the less you know, the more you know. And a lot of people have told me about my attention to detail. I think it really boils down to how important or how much does the shot matter to you? For me, for every client that comes in my door, I would like to think that they're all very important to me, and everyone has a different need and different approach, not just in photograph, but especially behind the camera and how you communicate. You need to pick up a few things to be able to understand how to navigate any situation. If there's an advantage for me as a photographer, I think it's the meticulousness to details, but not just in the image itself, but with picking up little cues here and there, especially in negotiation. I think if you are quick in picking signals up, then you'll be able to navigate negotiations a lot more. You'll be able to know if, not just in pricing, but if they're going to go towards you or not. And if it's not going towards you, then maybe you can navigate it so you know what their needs are, so you can answer that need that they have that no one else can address. Developing the attention to detail, I think, comes through experience. I've definitely have failed a lot in my journey as a photographer. I still look back to some situation where I was like, oh man, I could have got that project if I didn't quote too high, for example, or the client would have come back to me only if I did X, Y, and Z, but I didn't. So I think it really comes down to experience. The more time you put into it, the more it becomes natural, like breathing, to anybody, I think. So
yeah, I definitely agree. I think we've all had those moments where we're just banging our head against the wall. Like, why did I do that one thing? Everything could have gone so differently. So I totally feel you on that. And I'd love to go back to this topic of negotiation in terms of reading a client when you're in that negotiation process. Are there any specific things that you really keep in mind or look out for? Because I feel like this is something that everyone is kind of continuously honing as a skill. So I'd love to hear your techniques.
Oh, I love this question. It's actually hard for me right now to not be the one to ask questions. It really boils down to one thing, I think. And it's a three word that I always use. It's tell me more. The more information you get from the other party, the more you can curate your approach. So that's one. Another one is the less you speak, the more the other person feels heard. And negotiation is really about feeling heard. The other party will not agree to your terms if they feel like they're not heard. Because a lot of the negotiations, especially for someone who's not really skilled at it, is that you're just saying your terms instead of understanding why they are coming with maybe that usage fee, that budget that they have. Because once you understand it, for example, let's just put it in the photography client perspective. Someone comes to me, let's say, and their budget is half the budget that I would like to ask. Now, I need to understand why. Number one, what are their needs? If they're thinking it's going to be a full day, maybe I can cut it into half day. Maybe their experience in the past photographers that they have is a lot longer than my shooting time. So I had to educate them. Now I say, okay, like I can definitely work in your budget, but I think we can get this accomplished in half day. And wouldn't it be nicer if we do it in half day so we can have more free time? You can enjoy maybe time with your kids or being out in the sun. You can get your suntan when it's summer. And at the same time, you cut your costs. So it's really about listening, I think, when it comes to negotiation. A lot of us like to talk, which I think we have to get comfortable in the silence as well. And there's also the tonality that you have to use when you're negotiating. I call it the midnight DJ voice. Your low, I kind of am using it right now, I guess, your low note. And then when you are trying to persuade somebody or to tell you more, you use the upward tone where you're more excited. It's like, oh, that's really great. You're always kind of going up, kind of like the Canadian accent in a way. But yeah, so it's really about listening and keeping that calm energy, I think, in negotiation is very important.
Yeah, definitely. Something I always think about with negotiating as well, and I think something that comes easily for me out of why I started an agency, is just always putting myself in their shoes and understanding or remembering back to what I was looking for or the pain points that I felt, and kind of thinking about how I can help them from the other side too, which I'm sure you can relate to having been an art director before being a photographer and bringing on that talent, is like, what were you looking for? What would make the process easier for you? And all of that as well.
Yeah, you're actually really good at this. I've seen you multiple times when we're chatting. You're so good at it that sometimes I can't read it.
Oh, really? That's
like,
too funny.
Like, what is Jasmine thinking? Am I going the right direction or not? And usually for me, that throws me off my game when someone is listening, because it doesn't happen often. But yeah, so you're really good at that.
Oh, thanks. Interesting to hear. I feel like that's something I've been practicing lately. I actually want to take that master class. I'm forgetting his name.
Chris Voss.
Yes. Have you taken that one?
I read his book like a Bible.
Okay.
I read that 3 times. So the first time I read this, my computer broke down and it's 3 months outside the warranty.
Oh, the worst. That always happens too. Yeah. It's like they do it on purpose.
So I phoned them, and then because of the negotiation tactic that I learned, the person on the phone extended it for another month.
Oh, wow.
So I took it to Apple. They said they couldn't fix it. Went back about 3 times. And at the end, I used this phrase that says, what am I supposed to do with that? In a very calm tone, I said, what am I supposed to do with that? You guys tried to fix it. It's under warranty. Clearly, it's not working. Are you sure you couldn't replace it? And they said, like, we replaced everything internally already. We couldn't find the problem. So I guess at this point, we'll just have to give you a new computer. That's when I realized the power of that negotiation book. I honestly think it's one of the best negotiation book. Since you're thinking of doing the masterclass, I highly recommend the book over the masterclass.
Okay, good to know. Okay,
the masterclass is good in examples,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot in the book that wouldn't be in the masterclass, I think.
Okay, I'm going to read that one.
This is brought to you by Masterclass.
Yeah, sponsored by Masterclass. So something that I noticed is that when AI entered our sphere, a lot of creatives, professionals in general, were really scared of this technology and what it meant for their career. Whereas I saw you harnessing the technology to your advantage from the very beginning. And I think that so speaks to your character and how capable you are of continuing to pivot as times change. But I'd love to talk about your thoughts on AI, but also in general, your willingness to adapt within your business.
Yeah, oh, I love that. First off, I do believe that AI is going to wipe out a lot of jobs. Second, I think we're going to innovate new opportunities because of this new technology. If you look at the history, for example, originally it was painters, and then photography came in. So painters are probably not happy at the time. I can imagine that they were getting commissioned by this royalties, for example, to do commissioned paintings that they would finish for maybe weeks or months. And then photography happened, and it's just one click, it's done. So I can imagine that at the time, painters weren't happy. And then when AI images, particularly in image creation, came out, a lot of photographers were not happy about it. But my thoughts are, this is the same thing that had happened centuries ago. It's just in a different context. Now it's a lot faster. With AI, I think, I always say it this way, you can't stop a tidal wave with a finger. It's going to come no matter what you want. So you might as well embrace it and be one of the people that shapes it. I've always wanted to be in front than at the background. That's how much I want attention, I guess. So, but when it comes to the AI, I've maximized AI in a way that made my business, the lifestyle and workflow very seamless. For example, we all know about ChatGPT. I've heard people before, I was in a party when ChatGPT was new and said someone use it to send an angry email to the gym that they go to. And I thought it was funny that someone would use ChatGPT for angry email. But I get it. The person, he's not a native English speaker. So it definitely helps him curate the right words, I think. For me, for example, I use it in some of my content. I run out of ideas. And oftentimes it's not perfect. You do have to tweak it. When people say like, oh yeah, it's great, don't have to tweak anything, I think they don't fully understand AI yet, if that is the language that they're talking about. Another one for me is I own a retouching company. We used to retouch about 10,000 images. One single retoucher, like me, for example, sometimes I would retouch with my team. I can finish at maximum 300 in 24 hours. And that's me really pushing it. Now, one single retoucher can handle 10,000 images.
Wow.
So we're paying.
Wow, it's a really revolutionary
start for you. It's crazy. Like our turnaround is less than 15 hours. Image would come, for example, and 2 hours later, it's all done.
I noticed that in your delivery times, because it used to be up to a week after a shoot. And I feel like now it's just getting faster and faster every time we shoot. So that's so interesting to hear. Yeah. Do you find that clients are trying to, so not necessarily a client that you're doing photography for, but rather a client that you're only doing retouching for, do you find that more of them are trying to do it in-house, or has that not really impacted things yet?
The funny thing is, it hasn't impacted us yet.
I wouldn't think so.
I know it will.
Yeah. Once more people are able to harness the technology themselves, I think. Because right now it's still that time where, especially on the image side of things, where people aren't necessarily sure how to use the technology yet or how to use it as effectively as you and your team, of course. I feel like we're kind of teetering on the edge in terms of the timeline there.
I think the ones that would benefit from retouching in general are e-com houses. I don't think portraiture would change. Or if you're doing a luxury brand campaign, for example, I think those will not get affected as much. But for e-com, anything that is mass produced, I think will change. Going back to AI again, I was talking to another photographer about this and how we think it might change. I think B2B photography-wise is going to change a lot, but B2C is not. I can't imagine a parent wanting a photo of their children would generate an AI image to put in their wall.
Yeah.
But I can imagine a business trying to save money, like I would as well. One of the ways to cut it down is through hiring photographers, unfortunately. But that's just the truth about it. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to start innovating and integrating AI rather than not knowing how to integrate it later on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think something that's been interesting too is seeing how it can also open so many doors to new opportunities, things that maybe couldn't have realistically been photographed, like the project we collaborated on with the planes. It's like that technology would not have been photographed in the sky realistically. So being able to generate those images gives them the possibility of even having those images that wouldn't have even been something on their radar prior to AI. So I think seeing it being used in ways of generating images that wouldn't even be possible has been really cool to see.
Yeah, 100%. And those are the projects that excites me when we get to do it, because there's no freaking way we can get that speed.
But yeah. I see you as someone who has transformed photography from simply a service to a more all-encompassing and thriving business in the way that you think about your advertising, your marketing, your relationship building, subset businesses that you can create. What inspired you to go in that direction? Was it business experience prior to photography, or how did that look?
Isn't that funny? I remember this particular moment in my life. So I wasn't always been a business-minded or forward thinker. I remember this one time I was lying down on the couch, and this is prior to TikTok. I stumbled upon video of Mark Cuban saying that be an expert in one thing and then expand. I was like, oh man, that's such a great, I don't know why that's, anyway, at the time I was like, this is such a great idea. So what can I do? And at the time I only saw myself as a photographer. So what can I do that can go beyond photography? This is probably in 2016, I think. And this is when I start thinking, okay, right now all I'm doing is serving people through my photography, but there's got to be more than this. I took what he said, be an expert in one thing. And then from there, you can expand. So for example, like in a retouching company, for example, my wife and I invest in real estate. I have this product that's coming out in a few months that's photography related. I open a community for photographers, that which is growing pretty well, I think, that at least well than I expected. And it all stems down from one thing, I think. It's my photography background. At the time, there wasn't a lot of course creator. I'm not a course creator yet, but maybe one day we'll get there. But what I did is I tried to be really, really good at what I do. And I realized, again, it's not just about the technicality aspect, but what are the things that photographers are struggling at? A lot of photographers are struggling in making money, or any artist, I think. A lot of artists are struggling with that. So if I become really good at that and show people that it can be done, maybe people would listen more to what I'm saying, and then I can show them the way for it. So the reason why I use photography as my main thing is because I didn't really have much choice. It's the only thing that I have. I was a graphic designer, but I tried applying for a graphic designer job here and couldn't get any because of this design aesthetic that I have at the time was very different from North America. In Asia, everything is poppy and colorful. There's too much happening. In North America, it's a lot more tame. It's a lot more minimal. And I did not understand the design aspect. I guess when people finally remember my name as a photographer, other photographers start to notice it. And then it became a lot easier to now sell other things. Like my mentorship, for example, this morning I just had a meeting with someone who booked a consultation, and one of their struggles is they're afraid that they might not see results. So I tried to understand the three layers of why you're afraid to do that, to jump into this, and you're afraid that you might not get it. And I realized that they've done courses before. They've listened to other mentors that I think should not that they should not be teaching, but it's more that they're making a living through their course, not through photography. So I'm not sure if you're answering this question, but I think to boil it down is it really started with that video of Mark Cuban saying, be expert in one thing and then expand. And now everything that I do is somewhat related to photography.
Yeah, which I think is a good way to be. I think I was saying recently, I feel like there's kind of two types of people, and both routes work well for different people, but they're the people that are more directly on one path and focus in that direction and whatever kind of branches off of that direction. And then there's people that kind of follow more of creating lots of different things at the same time and seeing which one actually lands and then running with that one. And I've always been more like you, where I kind of am like, okay, choose one gear and then go in that direction. So it's interesting you say that.
I like that you mentioned that. The more you meet entrepreneurs, the more you realize that entrepreneurs just want to A-B test. You just want to test which one works. And it's kind of fun doing it because not every idea will work. But what if that one single idea worked? Then you keep growing that branch. And if it doesn't work, you learn from it and move on. I understand that not everybody's like that. I think you and I were probably more risk-averse, I think. We're okay to risking a little bit of our time, a little bit of our money, and some are not. But yeah.
So going back to this mentoring, you've been taking on more teaching roles both through mentorship and your Instagram content. How has that experience been for you so far?
Oh, I love it. I used to teach photography in a local college here. This is right after my day job. And then I couldn't find another source. After my day job, I thought I could just make it as a photographer. 3 months after, I realized like, oh, I need another job. So I took this teaching course. And then I think about a year after that, my photography starts to do really well. So I had to let that go because of timing. And then when I was able to navigate my timing a bit more, I tried to go back, but they're not accepting any more teachers. So that being said, I love teaching, especially seeing the results of what other people do with the knowledge that you share. That's definitely one of my highlights, I think, in any part of my life and my career. I've always had mentors in my life. I had mentors in advertising when I was working for a family business. My dad was my mentor. When I came here, I have two photographer mentors. Right now, I have two as well that are kind of coaching me. I consider authors and books mentors as well. Like one of classic one is Jim Rohn, for example, Chris Voss from Negotiation. I personally enjoy sharing knowledge. There's this book that I read called The Go-Giver, and he said there's four or five laws in it. The first law was the law of compensation. You should be giving more value than what you get in compensation. And the question pops up, it's like, well, how can I make money that way? And the second law was the more you serve, the more you get paid, basically. And not that it's all about money. But one thing I like about teaching is it's literally serving other people. To be honest, for example, this community that I just opened about a week ago, I'm not sure if I'm going to monetize this. I'm not sure if I can monetize it, but it fulfills me in doing this. There's another challenge that I did a few months ago where I was trying to teach show photographers how to make extra income. So challenge was $0 in 3 months, create not passive, but an extra income. I documented everything, build an online community for it. And I closed the community because I noticed that photographers are not really interested at outside photography. But the funny part is that became, because of building that community, that became my, someone kind of like keep me in check because I would feel embarrassed if I don't give them an update of the promise of the 3 months. And through that, I was able to create this new business that's coming out in a month or so.
Yeah, I'm so excited for that one too. Officially launch. Yeah, I think that definitely what you're saying about teaching being so fulfilling. I also find that having teaching opportunities allows you to learn from what you're teaching, but also to kind of sit back and reflect on what you've learned so that you can teach it. Whereas I feel like we get so caught up in the day-to-day, or at least I do, that sometimes I'm learning all of these things and adapting in these ways, but I don't ever take a chance to actually absorb all of those findings unless I'm relaying it to someone else. So I find that teaching can be so beneficial in that way as well.
One thing that also all about teaching is, for example, in my mentorship right now, I can only handle 3 students a month. Actually, a lot of it is me just listening. They always say like it felt like a therapy afterwards because they're just saying, and then I'm actually the one learning a lot from their experience. One of the things, I think we kind of briefly talked about this on our last shoot, about companies always focus on product development, but they miss the most important part, which is customer development. And for me, just listening to my mentees, for example, or the people in the community, is giving me a lot of insight as to what the pain point is of that community. So when I'm ready to create a product or a course, let's say, or create a mentorship that's a very specific pain, I know what to target. And I already have a customer base because of the actual customers that I interviewed. It is a little bit off topic, but you know when a friend would tell you like, hey, I have this idea, and then they would ask their friends, a lot of their friends would say like, oh yeah, it's a good idea, I'll buy it. But when it comes to the actual product being there, would they actually buy it? And I think the problem for that is because there's really no customer development process. It was just like, I have an idea, would you buy it? So
yeah. And also when it's your friends, it's like remembering that a lot of times you're in a bubble with your friends. You all kind of think about things in a similar way. Even if you might all buy it, what does the rest of the population look like? Are they going to be interested? Going back to mentors, I feel like you've done a really good job at finding mentors all throughout your career. And I know that some people feel really lost on how to approach a mentor. How do people even get mentors? So where would you suggest starting with that?
Good question. I mean, I can only speak on the way I did it. I did it in multiple ways. One is, how can I provide value to my mentor? For example, when I get a lot of emails saying like, hey, would love to assist you and learn from you. The main problem from that email is there's no value that they're giving to me.
I'm so glad you said this because this is exactly what I would say to anyone that asked me this question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if the email was like, hey, I would love to learn from you. I'm happy to carry this handbag, run for coffee, anything you want. Like, I'm your guy, basically. That now to me has a value. Now I know that on set, they're not just going to be in my ear asking me questions. It's comparison to the one that, hey, I would love to learn from you. Can I assist? Nothing. That's the first thing. I think in general, anything in life, find a way that you can provide value, especially to the ones that are really important to you or to the progress in your life or career. Value really boils down in two things, I think. And I hate the word value these days because a lot of people overuse the word value. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm providing value. Shut the Shut the fuck up. So, anyway, if we really try to narrow it down, I think it boils down to two things. That is time and money. If you have done the time so other people don't have to do it, that is valuable. For example, telling me what it's like to open an agency. For me, that would be very valuable because I haven't done it. And I wanted to learn from your mistakes or things that you did, right? The other one is money. I say, give me 10 bucks and I can make you $10,000. That is value. That's direct, tangible value. So for mentors, for example, one, it's time. Like, what can you give in exchange of your time aside from wanting to learn from you? For example, for real estate, I've reached out to a few investors and realtors for this that I wanted to learn from. And this one person that said yes to me that I really like, and they said, basically they're down to mentor me, but I need to look for deals for them. But what it did to me is it made me really sharp as to what a good deal and a bad deal is. Because I'm going through like 100 deals a day trying to find the right house at the right place at a really good purchase cost, right? The other part is if you really want someone to mentor you and they're not answering, you offer them money. It's as simple as that. How much do you think the person is worth? And if you, for example, this is one photographer that I offered, it's pretty high. I offered this person $5,000 for a 1-hour meeting. My DMs wasn't going through. I emailed the person's assistant, didn't hear back. I found this person's email, didn't hear back. I send them a mail and finally responded to my email. When I'm desperate to learn from somebody, I'm really desperate and wanted to learn that. So that person I thought was worth the $5,000, at least for me. Their 1 hour is definitely worth it. That actually ended up being like a 3-hour mentorship. I still have the person's contact info. I don't just want to hit them up and say like, hey, can we do another one? I think there's no value to them. Anyway, the other part of if you wanted to link for mentor, it's either just pay them for it. It's as easy as that. And then pay them when you know that you're going to make it back. If you don't think they're going to learn much from them, of course, number one, why even bother to reach out to them? So
yeah, definitely. And I think especially if you're paying for mentorship or consulting, it's also understanding that you need to come prepared and not expect them to just sit there and give you value. Because I know in consulting sessions, of course, I'm happy to guide in terms of if I'm on the side of the consultant taking a call and there isn't much direction, but I just know that they'll get so much more value if they're ready with the questions.
Yes.
And on my side, at any time I know that I'm really paying up for an hour of someone's time, it's like I better really know my questions and narrow them down to the most important ones. So.
Oh, that's so true. Because a lot of people also would approach you and mentorship. And then when you jump in a meeting, it's like a deer in the headlights. They have nothing to ask. So that's very important to do your research first, not just about the person, but what do you want to learn? For me, for example, there's two questions my wife actually told me about this that I really love. And I'm doing this right now to my online community. When they sign up, there's a question like, what are your top 3 biggest struggle right now? And then the next question is, if you have a magic wand, what is something that you would do to change something in your current situation? Technically, those two should be the same, but the more honest question is the second one. And the reason why I'm doing this is a bit outside what we're talking about, but the reason why I'm doing this is so I understand what their pain point is. So I have a background research in how I can talk to them. In this situation, it's a little opposite because I'm the one who's teaching, but I'm also the one asking. But I like that you mentioned that people that approach you, whether it's a lawyer, for example, if you're doing consultation with a lawyer, make sure that you have at least the basic knowledge off the topic that you're going to be talking about, or else you just wasted your free consultation.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me about some of the biggest challenges you faced in your career so far and what advice you would give to someone in that same position now.
I think the first one would be, I was definitely egotistical when I started.
We've all had that moment.
Yeah, we think we're better than the rest. We think we know more than anybody. And I think that the quicker you understand that you don't know anything, the easier it will be to conduct business with others, I think. Mm-hmm. That's definitely one of my biggest. If I have any regret, that would be that I wish I read more books, listened to more people earlier in my life. In the past year, I've really started to love reading books. I consume a lot of online courses. I have this joke that I'm so nerdy, so this is better than Netflix. I'm watching like an online course somewhere about business, for example, or as you know, I'm a nerd when it comes to tech, how to integrate this 5 different programs. So when someone emails me, it automatically answers for me, for example, to knowing all that. And there's a lot of free courses out there. It's amazing how many free courses are out there that no one is consuming, I think. I think one of my regrets is not learning more from others. I was definitely a person who thinks I got everything right. The way I pitch has that vibe as well, that I feel like rubbed off to people that are mature enough at the time that might have went through the same phase, I think. So that's probably my biggest regret.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think that not to be so woo-woo, but I feel like as well, when the ego gets too out of control, the universe will be really quick to just stomp you down and remind you of how bad things can get. I definitely have had a couple of those moments. So. Yeah.
And sometimes you don't learn from one situation, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, you won't even see it in the beginning. It's like, why are people leaving my business?
Yeah, definitely. It's like,
well, probably because of you. So, yeah.
I love hearing about people's achievements to date because I feel like it can spark ideas for new goals that other people maybe haven't even considered. So what would you consider being one of your biggest achievements to date?
Huh, that's a hard one. It's funny because once you achieve an achievement, it doesn't feel like anything. So it's like, okay, what's the next one?
Yeah, well, that's actually something that Devin, my business partner, and I have been really focusing on, is that we would always reach one goal and then move on to the next one so quickly that it almost psychologically, you're not even absorbing the fact that you are accomplishing things and you feel like you're just constantly in this hamster wheel of needing to get to the next step. So we've been trying to make a list of goals that we want to hit and making sure that we actually acknowledge and celebrate those wins along the way. And honestly, it kind of makes a difference. I feel like the work satisfaction goes up once you start acknowledging the things that are going right.
So I need to be better at that.
We can be accountability partners.
Yeah, yes, please. I think for me, if there's milestones, I guess, it would be when I finally got my own studio. I think that was a big milestone. When I finally hit the number that I want annually, that was definitely a milestone. When I start attracting the client that I'd like, even before they start booking me, but just having the conversation. But I guess for me right now, if there's one milestone that I would like to reach, I think I put so much of my time in the last 10 years in photography. I love photography. I'll always be a photographer. But now I'd like to step out a little bit from it. And it's one of the reasons why I'm trying to establish other businesses, not outside photography, but around photography, so I can have that freedom. Everybody talks about freedom. We talk about time freedom and financial freedom. People define it differently, I think. But my definition of what freedom is to me is to be able to say no to a job because I have something more fulfilling to do.
Oh, that's so funny. A friend and I were just talking about that on a walk. We were talking about the difference between having a packed schedule and a full and fulfilling life. And it's like, I can go through times where I'm back to back busy all day long, but if all of the things I'm doing are aligned and fulfilling, I feel completely fine with being that busy. Whereas if it's a packed schedule with all of these things that you're not really enjoying and you're just doing for the sake of doing, it feels a completely different feeling, like so draining. So I totally agree with you on being able to prioritize things that are fulfilling and that being a real game changer in how you feel about your life.
Yeah, I think kind of like to build on what you were saying, it's so easy to be busy. I actually really trying to remove it in my vocabulary that I'm busy because everybody is.
It becomes
busy.
Such a cop out. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody's busy. I like being busy. And some people might say, like, you work too hard. I get depressed if I don't work. And I think it's because I love what I do. I'm okay staying at 3 a.m, waking up at 7 a.m. I feel like, so this is one of my strategies that I'm doing right now. If we redefine winning into winning would be you keep doing everything you can until there's nothing else you can do, then you won the day. For example, let's say my goal today is to email 500 people manually, one by one, very curated. If I do my best, at least my very best, until my body can literally do it anymore, and I only reach 300, I think, I would say that's a win for me. That's a better win than me sending an automated email, for example. 500 emails is easy. To send 500 emails, and then I would just call it a day because I automated it. For me, that's not a win because I didn't give my every ounce of energy that I can to achieve the goal that I want. Yes, if we redefine winning as that, then I think we will, number one, feel better. Then we have more wins than losses, I think, in our perspective. And it pushes us to really go for our goal, I think.
Definitely. You've shared a few really valuable resources already today, but I feel like every time I see you, you have a good book or a good podcast or something to mention. So what is one resource you would leave the audience with today if they were to look up just one thing?
It will be The Go-Giver that I just mentioned a while ago. That book made me understand what true value is. It's not like, for example, for me, since I make content on social about for photographers, it's not five things you need to do that no one gives a fuck. It's about what do they actually need that you can provide that would change that. If you understand, I think, what value really is, then you'll be able to understand why it's important to be a go-giver, why it's important to give more than to receive. And it's a cliche, right? We always hear that. My background is I'm a Christian by faith. Christians always say like, oh, you have to be a giver. You're such a go-giver. But I feel like we don't really understand what that means. Being a go-giver is not about giving money. It's about listening and understanding what the needs are and providing that to them. And hopefully through that, you're smart enough to monetize it. That's why the more you give, the more you receive.
Yeah, I actually still have that one on my book list from last time I saw you. So I need to get to that one.
Yes, get the Audible. I enjoy the Audible.
I know. I really need to do more audiobooks because I'm always listening to podcasts. But I feel like if I just work in more audiobooks, I'll get through more books.
I want podcasts too, but it's just so many, right?
I know. There's so many options. As well as a resource to leave with our audience, do you have any one piece of advice that you would give to aspiring photographers looking to make their mark?
First, learn how to use your camera, of course. After that, find mentors. And then find other ways to make money. There's this discussion right now between a few friends of mine that are photographers about the myth of reoccurring income for photographers. It's funny because I'm one of the people that before that would say, oh yeah, reoccurring income for photographers. Now that I'm really looking into it, I actually think it's a myth. MRR for photographers is a myth, I think. There is, I wouldn't call it reoccurring, but there is an incoming flow of cash. You can create that. But it's hard, almost impossible, unless you fit it in-house, to create a reoccurring income. Because a reoccurring means that it's coming from the same source. So yeah, I want to debunk that right away. So people would now have their mindset of, okay, if I can create an MRR, what are the ways that I can have consistent income? And I think that is the right frame of the question for income-wise. So yeah, I think it would be those things. So
okay, awesome. And where can the audience find you and your work and follow along with your journey?
They can just visit my website. It's noahasanias, that's ASANIAS.com, or just find me on Instagram with my name. And for anyone who might be interested in joining the community, it's just school, SKOOL.com/photopreneur.
Amazing. That's rough.
Sweet.
Yay. Thank you,
Noah. We did it.